Welcome to Series 3 of This Wildlife Podcast, a conservation podcast that brings you up to date with frontline conservation efforts from across the world. We talk with experts who have dedicated their lives to protect our beautiful planet. From wildlife vets, to bush pilots, to rangers leading anti-poaching operations, and those who work undercover to dismantle the illegal wildlife trade. We are This Wildlife Podcast, and we're here to bring the wild to you.
As usual, I'm Amy Turner, and welcome to another episode of This Wildlife Podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be here with a guest who has seemingly travelled to every corner of our planet in search of stories. Jeremy Hance, who joins us today, is an environmental journalist and writes for both Mongo Bay and The Guardian. Today we'll be chatting about a range of topics, from a very talkative Bornean rhino called Tam, to what it's like to cover and write about some of the world's most critical environmental topics. And we will also hear some of Jeremy's stories of his extensive travels from the Amazonian rainforest to the plains of Kenya. Let's just say it's a delight to have Jeremy with us today. So Jeremy, welcome onto the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, no, I really appreciate excited to talk about all these different things.
So I feel like I've really got to know you over the past few weeks as I've been reading your captivating and somewhat hilarious book called Confessions of a Globetrotting Hypochondriac. You know, it's funny, I can relate to this book and the story it tells in more ways than one. But for those at home who don't know your background, please could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your career so far?
Sure. Yeah. So I've been an environmental journalist now for about over 10 years. I got my start at the website Mongo Bay, which is a global website that covers a lot of tropical forests, especially, but sort of increasingly kind of any environmental news. And then eventually went freelance and had a Guardian blog for a while and have written for a lot of different places. You know, my first love when it comes to journalism is really wildlife, but I also really enjoy writing about climate change, indigenous people, all sorts of things. But I really have always been fascinated with animals and endangered species ever since I was a child. And so that is tends to be what pushes me, especially when I'm traveling. Usually when I'm traveling somewhere, it's for a story about a species, and often a species that few people have heard of or sort of more hidden and mysterious. And I kind of push myself to go and try and find it in the wild. And so that tends to be what pushes a lot of my travel writing.
Awesome. Now let's dive straight into a story that you highlight in your book. You describe a pretty powerful encounter with a Bornean rhino called Tam. It was a story that really showcases the character of one rather likable rhino and was very, very moving. Please could you tell us about Tam and how Tam has influenced your work to date?
Yeah, so I met Tam just a couple of years after I started doing the environmental journalism thing. And at that time, Tam was one of a few Bornean rhinos. And the Bornean rhino it's either considered a subpopulation or a subspecies of the Sumatran rhino. And I went to Malaysia, to Malaysian Borneo, where they had Tam in a captive situation, but it was captive in the sense that, like, they had found him in a palm oil plantation where he had injured his foot, and he just walked into the palm oil plantation one day. Basically, no one really knows why, but probably in some ways, like, just desperate and alone. At that point, his habitat had been, you know, broken up by deforestation, by palm oil, and he was probably one of the last rhinos ever in that part of the world. So he walked into this plantation, and luckily the wildlife authorities got there before anybody would think, oh, let's just kill this thing for its horns, right? Because that's often what would happen. And they brought him into captivity. And so I got to meet him just a couple years after that. And, you know, I'd been to places like I'd been to Kenya, and I'd been to Botswana, places where they have, you know, white rhino and black rhino. And so you kind of get the impression, and I think there's sort of this idea about rhinos in our culture that they're sort of gruff and rough and charge first and stuff. And you know, and I had been charged by a white rhino in Kenya while in a vehicle, like it was perfectly safe, but it was still an intense experience. But the more scientists learn about rhinos, the more we learn, you know, just what emotionally complex species they are. And the thing about Sumatran rhinos is they are a forest-dwelling creature. They're not a plains animal, as far as we understand. And when I met Tam, he was just, he was very personable. He was smelling me. He was rubbing up against the cage. He was very curious about me. He kept thinking, you know, I think he was really curious if I had food for him. And he was just a really beautiful animal. And Sumatran rhinos, they make these incredible noises that you would not expect out of a rhino. They sound almost like a dolphin or a whale singing. And then we don't know any, we have no idea exactly why they do this, but they're just constantly chattering, and they sort of, and I've met a number of Sumatran rhinos since. So they sort of sing to you, and it was a really amazing encounter. And what made it more poignant in the moment, was that, you know, just the knowledge that this is one of the last of this species, right? At the time, you know, scientists were saying, oh, we have a few hundred left of Sumatran rhinos. And probably at the time, I think they were saying maybe 100-200 Bornean rhinos. Well, that all turned out to be completely wrong. Tam was perhaps the last male Bornean rhino on Earth. There might be a couple more in the wild, but as far as we know, he actually passed away, I think about a year and a half ago, which was chilling for me because, you know, I had had this really, it's hard to, like, I could call it spiritual, I guess, moment with this creature that really left a lifelong impression and sort of got me down the rabbit hole of covering this species a lot. And I've sort of become the Sumatran rhino reporter for, you know, I've written about it for The Guardian. I've written about, I have some various series in Manga Bay about it. I've written about it for other places too. So, and I've done a lot of talking about this animal because I think it's such a representation of what we are losing in the world right now. And if a Sumatran rhino, which is a large, slow breeding mammal, can, you know, go extinct in sort of a brief amount of time after it survived millions of years, you know, I think that just, it's an important story to tell because it sort of highlights just how fragile we have made the natural world. And you know, this is an animal that is getting money. This is an animal that has concern and groups focused on it, whereas a lot of species don't. And it's still slowly vanishing. I would, today, the official number is under 100, under 80. I would hazard we're probably more closer to 50 to 60 animals left. And in Borneo, we have one rhino that we have in captivity. So for the Bornean subpopulation or subspecies, and one rhino that they know of in the wild. And that's all we know of. So perhaps just two animals. So we are at the precipice for this species, and it's come to a point where we have to make a lot of really hard decisions going forward. And to have met Tam and to have watched his story and to have seen that he was never able, for various reasons, he never had a child, a calf that we know of, at least. Maybe he had one in the wild, but there's none left in that area, so that's quite doubtful. And then to have had him pass away was really heartbreaking. You know, it's as a reporter, you're supposed to be somewhat, you know, pushed away from these things. But I think watching the way we're going in the world right now when it comes to the environment, it's increasingly impossible to just sort of emotionally disconnect. So he was a lovely creature, and I miss him.
I can see how you and everyone who knew him were affected by his story.
Yeah.
Now, throughout your book, there are a number of stories describing your encounters with a variety of species in many different ecosystems, from Indonesia to Guyana to Kenya to the Amazonian jungle. The list is truly endless. So what is the importance of sharing these stories, and how do you feel that this helps wildlife conservation?
Sure. So I think, you know, the older I get, the more I kind of realize that humans, we interact through stories. It's like what emotionally gets us, you know, when we've all been in lockdown this last year and stuff, I think most of us have turned to movies and TV, right, to sort of break the monotony and bring us a little joy and change. But we've been telling stories to each other for hundreds of thousands of years around campfires, right? Like when we were in just rising out of Africa in the Pleistocene, I imagine we sat around campfires and you know, told those first stories to explain who we are, what we are, why we're here. And so I think we, at least I know I do, but I think all of us, most of us really emotionally gravitate towards stories. So I see my role as a journalist as, and I didn't come to journalism from like being like, I want to be a journalist. I sort of fell into it. And I've always thought of myself more as someone who I love novels and I love stories. So I kind of approach it as a storyteller, especially when it's a, you know, it's one thing to write an article that's just sort of like this happened and this happened. But if I'm actually traveling somewhere, I want to tell that story, right? I want to tell that species story. And I think those stories then can add the emotional weight to really bring home the deeper messages of what it means to be a human today in our current world of crises of climate change and mass extinction and things going on. And hopefully to bring about, you know, some kind of change in the way we relate to the natural world. Now, but I'm only like, I say this as if like I can, you know, have this massive impact, but like, this is also like the only thing that I can really do. Like, I'm not much of an act. Like, I get nervous being in social situations. I'm not a huge activist. I have, I wouldn't be good at like managing an NGO. Like, I don't have the brain for certain things. But one thing that I'm good at is writing. And so that is sort of where I've decided to put my talents and to try and tell stories that, you know, you hope will move people and change people's minds, you know, and have an impact, and maybe in the end help move that needle a little bit for a species here or there, and hopefully they'll still be around you know, when my daughter's my age.
Now, I've got to say, the stories and anecdotes from your travels are extensive, entertaining, shocking, and sometimes downright hilarious. So in addition to your life-changing encounter with Tam, what has been your most memorable wildlife encounter or experience so far?
Yeah. I actually end the book, my travel memoir, with one of the stories. And it's sort of similar to the Tam story in that, like, it's one story that continues to stick with me. And it's the story of I traveled to the Dominican Republic to chase after this animal called the Selenodon. And a lot of people would probably have never heard of this animal. It is, looks like a giant rat, like really just looks like a giant rat. But it is not at all a rodent. It's in its own complete kind of line of species, and it's one of the weirdest animals in the world. It has large fangs that shoot poison venom. It's one of the only venomous mammals. It has these small beady eyes. It has a nose that actually has a ball and socket, and it's the only animal in the world with a ball and socket joint. If you've never seen a picture, seriously look it up, because it looks crazy weird. It has these long, gnarled claws, and when it walks around, it like looks like it's drunk, like it doesn't really walk very well because it spends most of its time underground eating insects. And my brain tends to get really obsessed with certain things. And so when I first heard about this animal, I was like, "What is this?" And I fell down a rabbit hole, read everything I could find about the Selenodon, and because I'd never heard of it until I was in my 30s, I think, late 20s. And what makes it so interesting to me, though, is that it has been around, at least as we think, somewhat unchanged since the dinosaur period. So this was an animal that somehow survived the comet or asteroid that wiped out most of the dinosaurs, that then survived the rise of mammals, that then somehow found itself on an island. You know, it was originally on the North American continent, and then as Haiti and the Dominican Republic, Hispaniola, as the island split off, that population survived. Then it survived humans coming to that island and wiping out most of the animals there, because most of the animals in the Caribbean, all the big mammals, have been wiped out. And it's still there. And so this is like this weird relic that should not be here. And it's such a strange animal. So I went to the Dominican Republic. I think I might be one of the only people who's ever gone to the Dominican Republic, which is one of the most beautiful places in the planet, like Caribbean beaches, you know. Not as a scientist, but literally just as a person to try and find this animal. Like, nobody goes to this country to find a Selenodon. But I was like, oh yeah, no, I need to see this. So I went and I followed around a scientist with me and my wife. And we had one night where I got to go with a local hunter who doesn't hunt Selenodon, but he hunts, you know, pigs and just knows the forest really well. And he catches these things by hand, which is crazy in itself. And we got to find a beautiful female, and 5 minutes, just 5 minutes of being with this animal was one of the most beautiful moments of my life. And that sounds weird because if you look up the animal, you're going to say this isn't like most people, this animal looks ugly and weird. But to me, it's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. It's like such an iconic survivor. It's such a weird, it just shows how strange evolution can be. And like spending just a few minutes with her after all that work, time, anxiety, money, energy to get myself out there, the days of travel, you know, to a very remote part of the Dominican, we were on the border of the Dominican Republic in Haiti. So a very remote part of the country, to have that moment with this animal was just like years of obsession being rewarded. And I will never forget it, you know, and I've written about it a few different places, but that's what I sort of, the long story of that is the last two chapters of my book, because I felt like this is a story that has become so important to me. I actually at one point was like, maybe I should write a book about the Solenodon. And my wife was like, no one's going to read a book about this. Jeremy, you're crazy. So I decided to but it's a really fun story because it's got all the adventure of running around with scientists, chasing, trying to find this animal, and you know, and in the end, having that success, that sort of reward for all that hard work. And you know, the scientists were studying the animal at that point, and what they needed to do. And then we got to re-release her back into her forest home, hopefully to continue on her way, her weird, strange way, as her ancestors have done for 70, 80 million years. So it was incredible.
And on that note, then, what has been your most challenging travel experience to date?
Yeah. So, you know, we kind of touched on this a little bit, but the book is about sort of, so I struggle with OCD and anxiety and depression. And so the book is really sort of what it's like to travel to these places when you struggle with those things. And, you know, I for a long time, I wasn't sure I wanted to write this book because it's very revealing. It's a very vulnerable thing to talk about mental health, especially so personally, but it kind of kept nagging at me and it kept being like, this is the story you need to tell. So I finally, you know, started to pursue it seriously. And part of what I wanted to do with this book is to talk about mental illness, but do it in a way that was, you know, humorous, because these stories are ridiculous. I get myself into really ridiculous situations. I have panic attacks on planes. I have panic attacks in countries. I do ridiculous things to assuage my anxiety in the moment. And so part of it was to capture that funny bit and to write about mental health in a way that I hope was, you know, I deal with my own issues a lot with humor. And so to do that, you know, with an audience and not write a book that is just sort of bleak. But the idea of traveling with anxiety, I think, you know, for a lot of us, we all travel produces anxiety, right? You're getting out of your comfort zone. You're getting pushed into situations you're not familiar with. And that's one reason why we do it, obviously. It's fun, it's exciting, it's new, but it also can be difficult. And I wanted to really honor that, because I think a lot of travel writing is by these travelers who are just really good travelers, you know, who tend to sort of just eat it all up and can speak the language or just feel really cool. And I love reading those travelers because it's almost like reading about a superhero, right? But for my own experience has been so different. So the book is really, you know, each chapter is sort of each chapter or two is a different trip. And each of them includes, I hope, moments of fun and amazing animals and wonder. But at the same time, it is also about me having panic attacks or doing something ridiculous. And I think, you know, I think looking back, I think one of the hardest parts of this was when I was first traveling. One of the first sort of really big trips I did was to Peru with my fiance, now wife. And what was so difficult is we didn't know, like I knew I had struggled with anxiety and depression. But at the time we didn't know I had OCD, which OCD is a whole different beast. And so I was just doing things on this trip, responding in ways that my fiance at the time was like, what is your deal, dude? And I also didn't understand why she couldn't understand, thought every animal we came across was a rabid. I thought we were going to die. You know, my brain was so keyed up. And at that point I didn't have a name for it. I didn't have the knowledge of what OCD is and how it works and how it sort of tricks you into believing something that is logically false, but you believe it nonetheless. And so that was a really, really rough trip, but it was also the trip, I think, that instigated, you know, sort of my mental health journey and as an adult, and also instigated really a reawakening of my love of wildlife and nature. That was the first time I'd ever went to the Amazon rainforest. And that was an experience that was probably the Amazon rainforest. I always tell people, you know, they say like, you know, what's your favorite place? I'm always like, well, Amazon and Sub-Saharan Africa. Like those are the two places that if you can ever go, if you ever have the opportunity, do it. It's a lifetime experience, either of those places. But going to the Amazon rainforest for the first time was just life-changing, really. Because I this is before I became a journalist. And that actually got me on the path to sort of that career. So I think that trip was probably the hardest, but also maybe the most rewarding, which is also part of the story of the book, you know, is that all these trips have been hard in different ways, but they all have the rewards, and I don't regret any of them. Sometimes I do things on the trip that I later regret, but I don't regret the trip itself, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you also paint a very high definition picture of the destruction you've seen. One example I can think of is the Amazonian rainforest and how you describe the palm oil plantations taking over that land. These experiences and these images must stick with you.
Oh, yeah. It lives with you. Yeah, I think this is one of the hard things about being an environmental, well, there's many, you know, but that's the hardest thing about being an environmental journalist is that you're witnessing the destruction, the loss, the bad decisions, the short-term thinking. I think oil palm is one of the particular difficult ones, partly because it's so concentrated in one part of the world. The destruction is so massive. The loss, you know, it's the loss of hundreds of millions year old rainforest and countless species that many of them don't even have names, and then the, you know, the impact on people too, because you're talking about burning. There's often all the fires and the smoke and the air pollution. I mean, you can go there and you can see it even when it's not burning season, and just the decision making that's gone into that. And I don't want to like try and single out sort of Indonesia or Malaysia, these places as sort of like, they're just sort of following the same model that we've been doing for a few hundred years. Like they're not doing anything that different. You know, in America here, we tore down all our forests and destroyed our prairie. Obviously in the UK, you know, you guys have lost most of your forest hundreds, you know, during the Roman times really. And then, you know, but it's there's something about watching it happen in an age when we actually know about climate change, in an age when we actually know about mass extinction, and in a time when, you know, there seems to be, we have the knowledge now to know that this is a really bad idea. And at the same time, you know, they're also choosing, you know, they're trying to choose, I mean, arguably, at least that's what they say, they're choosing economic development. But it's development at what cost, and the economic cost of this development is also really high, honestly. So there's a lot of there's a lot of other things going on in this. There's corruption. There's local people trying to fight against it. And also palm oil industry is known for child slavery and indentured servitude. I mean, there's a lot of really bad things within this industry. So it's difficult to write about because when you get up close to it, it is really emotionally impacting. But at the same time, you know, you also understand the more you write about it, the more you read, how complex it is, right? How there are people that have been lifted out of poverty, especially small holders who have turned their plots of land into this very lucrative crop. How oil palm is in great demand right now. And, you know, if we weren't doing oil palm, we'd have to do something else potentially, right? Because that, you know, so there's all these layers to it. But yes, it is gut-wrenching to be in a place where you see that kind of recent destruction, where you see the people who once lived next to rainforests, hunted in them, fished in the rivers, and now there's no rainforest left for them. The rivers are completely polluted. The fish populations are vanishing. The animals are slowly vanishing. Like they've lost their way of life, and now they have to live in a new way, either working in oil palm plantations, which is god-awful work, or trying to find a different way to live than they have for, you know, again, thousands of years in some ways, or at least hundreds of years. So it's being an environmental journalist is really emotionally tough. You know, you see things up close that other people maybe read about or maybe never hear about. And, you know, and then there's the frustration at the lack of action and the lack of change and the sort of the slow grind of politics and misinformation and lies. And so that's also very hard. So, yeah, it's rough. And you know, there was a debate when I was writing this book with my publisher and my editors about how much of this I should leave in. And how much of it I should, you know, how much should I talk about climate change and stuff? But like, I kept fighting over and over for like, no, you know, like I don't want the book to just be about destruction, but like, I'm going here for these reasons and I don't want to, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I want to, you know, so we ended up finding a good compromise where I got to keep a lot of this kind of stuff in. And I tried to like, it's not like the whole book is about this. You can find books that are just about this. And there's some really great writers who have really tackled this in much more complete ways. But I try to give that just that sense in a page or two of what it's like, and then, you know, move into other things as well. So
that's the negative side of things. But come on, is there anything we can hang our hope on?
Yeah, I think the Indigenous movement, the Indigenous peoples movement, that's sort of been was really quiet for a number of decades, and then really like in the 70s and 80s it started to rise up, and now I think there's a lot more voice coming from Indigenous people have really found their voice and their leadership, and against incredible odds and incredible oppression and in some cases genocide, have continued to fight. And I think that is hopeful. I think there is some growing awareness amongst world leaders and policymakers that they can't avoid climate change any longer. We'll see how that pans out after the coronavirus is a little more settled. But I do feel like there is some awakening, which I've been waiting for since the 80s and 90s. But I do feel like there's starting to be a growing awareness around that. I think there is potential for our species to make rapid change and to have sort of what, you know, you could call like a collective awakening or communal awakening. And I see that is possible. It's so hard to tell in the moment if that's happening. Like if you look at something like gay marriage, right? You know, when I was a kid, that wasn't even talked about. It wasn't even, you know, it was completely silent. There was no, and then in my lifetime, in 40 years, that's completely, you know, changed. It's become quite acceptable in most Western countries. And so I think we could have a similar waking around environmental issues where we start to see living with nature in a new way as normal. And there are like people, you know, there are these projects and these parks, and there is so much still out there. I think people forget that there are so many species still out there, and there's so many positive. I mean, we were talking about rhinos, you know, the white rhino was down to, I think it was like a few 50, 75 individuals, and now is at like 20,000. And even though they're being ravaged for the horn, you know, trade, they're doing way better than they were, you know, 100 years ago. So there are these stories. The European bison, you know, in Europe was down to 12 individuals. Now there's hundreds being rewilded across the European landscape. You know, there are these examples that we can look to and say this is possible. You know, and so I think that is what we have to hold on to, and mimic and do more of. You know.
Now, another point that I would like to touch on is that in your book, you talk candidly about your mental health and you describe your symptoms very fully and very openly. Please, could you describe how nature has helped you live along anxiety and OCD?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where, you know, when I was a kid, I would always, I grew up on a 40-acre farm, kind of a hobby farm at the time, still in my family, has been in my family for over 100 years. And my mom still lives out in the farmhouse today. And so when I was a kid, I think I escaped a lot to nature, especially when things were chaotic or rough. I did a lot of my play in nature, as children have done since the beginning, you know. That is where I really experienced, I think I found peace and solace without really being able to put a name to it. And it was only when as I got older and in the last few years and as a journalist, reading about the new science of how nature impacts our brains. There's a lot of new research showing that nature can decrease anxiety, spending time in nature, that it can even increase sort of healing. People that have been in hospital, they do better if they have a view of a tree than they do if there's no windows, which, I mean, this is literally scientific research. It's not like, this is like, there are, you can go look up the studies and stuff. And I mentioned some of them in my book. It sounds a little crazy, but it's true. And in some ways, it makes sense, because if you think about how humans evolved, we evolved within the natural system. We were a part of nature. And then, you know, in the most recent few hundred years, we've sort of increasingly separated ourselves from nature and created these artificial, you know, worlds around ourselves. And so I think that in doing so, we've sort of harmed ourselves a bit evolutionarily, or, you know, just our brains are a little bit like overstimulated all the time and confused. But getting out of nature, for whatever reason, and there's probably a number of reasons, sort of brings us back to a sense of calm, to a sense of inclusiveness. And one of the things for me when I travel is like, the worst time for me traveling is like the plane and then getting to wherever I'm going. Like, it's the transportation part of it. Usually when I get there and I'm in the natural setting, unless I'm like starting to get sick or something, like, which has happened a couple times, but usually when I'm there, my anxiety decreases and I just kind of, you know, go into that Zen state of this is what life is about, you know, especially in a place like the Amazon. It's impossible to be in the Amazon and not be spiritually moved. It really is. So that I think is both my own personal experience, but also, again, the research is out there. The Guardian has done some really good reporting on this. Like, it's not sort of new agey frou-frou-ness, which can be fun too, but like it's really scientifically evaluated and continues to be evaluated. And what they're finding is absolutely astounding.
Very interesting. Now, Jeremy, for those who are perhaps looking for a career in eco-journalism, do you have any advice or tips for those people?
Sure. Actually, it's funny because I work with interns at Manga Bay. So I'm always working with young sort of upcoming or people who are passionate about journalism. I think my first tip would be, and this is not to be cynical, but just like make sure it's what you really want, you know, and make sure it's what really fits, because it's a very competitive field. You would be surprised by, I think, how competitive it is, but a lot of people are really interested in this. And it's also a field that is going through a lot of flux, you know, with sort of the demise of newspapers and the rise of internet. There's a lot of kind of uncertainty. It's not a field where it's hard to make a living, you know. It's hard to make good money, especially in the beginning. But I would say if none of that scares you off, and you're really passionate about it, I think, you know, looking into various educational programs, I think starting a blog is a good way. I think just learning to write by reading really good journalists, reading really good writers, and it doesn't have to be environmental journalists and stuff, but just reading good journalists, good writers, good essayists, reading as much as you can. And then, yeah, trying your hand at it and, you know, pitching some stuff to places, writing some stuff, writing op-eds, write all different kinds of things. Don't just be like, I'm going to only write this, you know, and try to, you know, write for different topics and stuff. Because one of the things that you find is like, you know, you might think, oh, I want to write only climate journalism, right? But don't limit yourself, because part of what happens is you need to be broad, but then also you'll fall into various trends and focuses that you'll suddenly become maybe known for. Like I said earlier, I'm sort of become like one of the Sumatran rhino journalist people now. I never expected that. It was never like a plan, but it just sort of happened. So I think having that flexibility, but a lot of writers, you have to start somewhere. So you have to start with either pitching out sort of as a freelancer while you're probably doing some other job to make money, or, you know, going to get an education for it, trying to get some internships, often unfortunately unpaid, you know, and then crawling your way up. And then, you know, so it's really a job. It's not a job where you should go for if you think, oh, I want a stable career that I can, you know, really feel comfortable with or whatever. Yes, it's a job with a lot of meaning. Yes, you can have a lot of great experiences and adventures, but it's also a job with a lot of uncertainty and a lot of challenges. And also the emotional mental toll is real. You know, journalists are not well loved right now in our society for various reasons. Some of them accurate, a lot of them not. You know, we're just human beings, but there's a lot of flack coming down. And I think, you know, if you're saying, oh, I want to be an environmental journalist because I want to change the world environmentally, like, just make sure that the journalist part is what you want, because there are so many ways to get involved environmentally right now. Whether it's working at NGOs or working as in government, I mean, there's so many ways to fill that niche. that just makes sure that it's the writing part that you're really passionate about, because that's the part that's going to either make you successful or not. You know, you have to be obsessive about the writing part of it to really make it work. So, I mean, I'm not trying to dissuade anyone, but I just want people to understand that, like, I was very lucky. Like, I was ridiculously lucky getting in where I got in when I got in. I wouldn't say it was talent or anything. It was just initially luck. And then I learned on the job, right? And now I have the experience that I can, like, you know, do this pretty well most of the time, but I still make mistakes. So I think that, you know, it does take a bit of, like with any career, it takes a bit of luck and the right timing and stuff, but a lot of diligence and a lot of passion and just perseverance.
Well, Jeremy, that's an awesome insight into your life, your adventures, some weird and wacky species. Mm-hmm. It's been great to have you on the podcast today. Good luck with all of your future travels, and I'll be looking out for your stories on The Guardian and Wonga Bay. Jeremy, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've listened to This Wildlife Podcast, hosted and produced by Amy Turner and David Grant. To get updates on previous and upcoming guests, you can check us out on Instagram and Facebook. We want these vital conservation messages shared far and wide. So, if you fancy it, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, and please do subscribe on whatever platform you're listening on. It's awesome to have you along on this journey with us. We are This Wildlife Podcast, and we're here to bring the wild to you.